Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
In August 1993... a mother kissed a four-year-old son goodbye as he set off to make the short journey to a park in the tiny, close-knit village of Savona, New York. 5 minutes later, he was dead. The brutal killing of a defenseless child was shocking enough, but when the perpetrator was finally identified, it caused a national sensation, the shockwaves of which can still reverberate today. This is what happens when damaged children find unimaginable outlets for their anger. This is the case of Eric Smith. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case is one that I've wanted to cover, and it has, even though it's an old case, still got some current news, so to speak. And because of that, I think it's timely to do this. Again, it's always one of the scenarios when I'm dealing with child death that it really resonates as a mother. But also because children are the most vulnerable in our society. Children deserve safeguarding. And for those of you who don't know, I spent much of my career in safeguarding of children. So any case that is talking about child death is one that's particularly disturbing, particularly upsetting, but I also think very, very important to discuss. So let's talk about this particular case. Starts Monday the 2nd of August, 1993. Four-year-old Derek Roby. He left his home and all he was going to do was to make a short journey to summer recreation program that he'd been attending. I'm sure a lot of you as children used to go to summer schools. It's a way of you engaging with kids throughout the holidays. It's usually a lot of fun. If you may, found them slightly intimidating and terrifying. I won't lie. But nonetheless, when you settled in there, it was pretty good. And remember, this is a small community. So for Derek, it would have been a lot of fun. And he'd been attending this and was obviously looking forward to it. And when I tell you that where he was going was literally just a few hundred yards down the road on the street he lived, that's how close the proximity was to his home. Now, his mother, Doreen, she was not the type of mother who would normally let him go anywhere alone. She was a very hands-on mum. She was somebody who adored her son and safety was paramount to her. However, that particular morning, Derek's little brother, Dalton, he was being scrikey, essentially. He was being fussy. He was teething. We've all been there as parents. Or if you've got siblings who are younger than you, you'll remember those times where no matter what you do, everything's wrong because baby's struggling. And Derek tells his mother at this point, "It's okay, Mum. I'll go by myself." Now, that is deeply unusual for this family dynamic. It's not as if Derek was going off and doing things by himself on a regular. But remember, it's a few hundred yards down the road on the street that he lives. And as far as she is concerned, they're living in an incredibly safe area. And after a little bit of thought, Doreen thinks to herself, OK, I'll let Derek make this journey alone one time. She was sure he'd be okay, essentially. There were no roads to cross. And also, she'd spent a lot of time with Derek saying, make sure that you don't talk to strangers. So she was informing him of that stranger danger. I think for a lot of people who grew up in the 80s and 90s, there was quite a lot of emphasis and focus on stranger danger. I don't know whether we do it as avidly in our communities as we did back there, but there would be adverts on television. We had one called Charlie Says, and it was basically trying to make it kid friendly, but also informative regarding potential predators that could come along and suggest that you go and see their puppies or take some sweets off them and so on and so forth. So in the 80s and 90s, I think a lot of parents did have those conversations with their children. I'm sure they still do. I definitely had them with my own children, saying things like, if somebody comes over and tries to take you, scream, this is not my mummy, this is not my daddy, etc. So she's had that conversation. She has a level of confidence in the fact that Derek understands what is safe, what is not. And bear in mind again, this is an area that is small, it's close-knit, and it's very friendly. So people know Derek. So it's not just that she is thinking about the fact that she wants to look out for him as a parent, it's the fact that she has trust in the community that they will look out for him, because it takes a village to raise a child. And even though she's nervous, she genuinely didn't think he was going to bump into anyone that was inappropriate. Because Savona itself, so very little rural village in New York State, everyone knows each other. The actual population is less than 1,000. And as I said, Derek was gorgeous. He was just such a popular little figure in the area. He was very happy. He was outgoing. He was somebody who loved playing t-ball. That's junior baseball for us who are not schooled in such sports. And he was often said to position himself at the roadside on his bike, and he'd be waving at passing cars. There's just something so innocent and naive and beautiful and also lovely. And just the image in my head of seeing that little boy waving at the cars, it depicts a personality developing. It depicts a character unfolding. And certainly Derek was turning into a really lovely human. And he was even given the title of unofficial major of Savona. The locals absolutely adored him. So this is a wonderful place to bring up children. This is a safe place. And this is certainly somewhere where, as a family, Derek's family was embraced. So that morning, she sends him off with his packed lunch in his canvas bag. She kisses him and says, I love you. And he replies, I love you, Mum. And that would be the last time that she would ever see Derek alive. And they'd be the last words that either of them exchanged, at least in this universe. Now, Derek had only been gone 5 minutes. And suddenly, out of nowhere, Doreen felt this overwhelming, inexplicable feeling of panic. It just consumed her. And then, even though she put that to rest, as you do, I'm sure many of you out there have had situations where one of your children has ran off or you can't see them for a few seconds, and you just get that really overwhelming, dreadful feeling. It's like you're going to be sick. But she has this, it settles, and then 2 hours later, this is when thunder starts to roll in, the clouds start to really darken the environment around the area. She goes to collect her son from the park. But when she gets there, she realises he's never arrived. She reported him missing at 11 a.m. and then the search begins. Of course it does. This is a 4-year-old child who's just disappeared. There's police, dozens of local citizens, all of them immediately get involved. And within 4 hours, they make the most horrific discovery. They find Derek's little body. It's in a wooded area in a vacant lot. It's 3:45 p.m. when they make the grisly discovery. It's less than 100 yards from his home where he's found. And it doesn't take an autopsy for them to understand that he's really dealt with some serious, serious physical assault. The autopsy established that he'd been attacked in a way where blunt force trauma had been used, and also manual strangulation. What was also striking to them was when they looked at the position of the body, it appeared that he'd been arranged on a rock pile. His shoes had been placed neatly on each side of him. And very sickeningly, What they also were able to observe is his trousers had been pulled down and a branch had been inserted 4 inches into his anus. So for the individuals who actually discovered Derek's body, that was the scene that greeted them. Now, even though there was that horrific injury, so to speak, because a branch had been placed in the little boy's anus, they didn't feel that there was actually a sexual element to the killing. So there was no trace of semen. There was no other evidence of sexual trauma. So it looked more like an act of violence as opposed to sexual violation. It was saying something less about an individual being gratified by attacking a child in this way and more about rage. Now, at some point during the attack, another noted point is that the Kool-Aid from Derek's packed lunch had actually been taken and poured all over the horrific open wounds that were on his body. Also, banana had been crushed and pulverized nearby. These are quite unusual actions because if you contextualize what we're talking about here, it's not in context with what we'd see is a predatory pedophile attack or somebody who violently wants to murder. There is something else within this, is an element of something that doesn't quite fit. The Kool-Aid being poured all over the wounds, the banana being pulverized, it's very odd. And for investigators, it really stood out. Also, they were able to come to an understanding that literally had been killed minutes after leaving his home. Remember that inexplicable surge of panic that his mother experienced? Well, she believed that that was Derek letting her know that he died because it was in context with around the time that they do feel that he was murdered. So now they've got this little boy's body, and the reality of this horrific murder is starting to play out, and the community are aware of this, the murder investigation is immediately launched. Can you imagine how it would be for that little area? They know everybody. They're looking around and thinking, who did this? Which one of you did this? It totally changes your experience of where you live when something like this occurs, because all the trust that you have in your community, in your neighbors, all the trust that you have in your children being allowed to walk freely down the street, it's eradicated instantly and panic sets in. So the police close off all of the immediate area. They set up roadblocks. They don't want anyone coming in or going out because of the fact that they don't want to contaminate the area. They want to be able to check who's coming in, and certainly most importantly, they want to check who's leaving. Because due to the nature of the killing at that moment in time, of course, they're thinking to themselves, okay, we've got to look at excluding paedophiles. Because due to the nature of the killing, they have to suspect that there could be, even though it doesn't look like a classic sexual attack, because there has been that branch inserted into Derek, they have to consider the potential that it could be an older paedophile or another individual who's got some kind of history of sex crimes. Now, the police were pretty quickly able to establish that this unknown pickup truck had been seen near the crime scene. So at this point, the police just start a desperate search for it. Because of course, if you've got a child killer who has murdered a four-year-old, then the chances are there's a very strong likelihood that they're going to strike again. So it's absolutely integral to the investigation to make sure that they are locating anybody who may be considered a suspect in that scenario, because you don't want further deaths to occur. Now, over 500 people will be spoken to over the next few days. This is both potential suspects, but also locals, because when you're compiling information, when you're figuring out how this could have played out, you want to speak to everybody because every person can see something different. And there's such a value to being able to have those conversations, because what you may have felt was negligible information, when it's placed with other information, can be something that literally breaks a case. But no suspect is actually identified as being the potential perpetrator. And one of the local parents spoken to by the police was Tammy Smith. Now, like other families in the area, she was absolutely horrified by what had happened. She was terrified for the safety of her own three children, because at the end of the day, we're in a scenario where this person could strike again. Nobody knows who this chameleon is, this predator is, walking around their community, waiting to strike and potentially take another life, maybe even one of her own children. Now, one of her kids, That was her 13-year-old son, Eric. He'd actually been attending the recreation program that day, and that was just near where the killing took place. So Tammy was absolutely terrified. She was having that sliding doors moment, the reality to think that it could easily have been her son who was killed. So she asked Eric if there was anything that he'd...
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Seen that morning, and he said that he hadn't seen anything. But when he was talking to her, and bear in mind that this was Eric's mother, and therefore, understandably, she knows him. When you've got kids, they can try to lie to you or distort the truth a little bit, but you kind of get an inkling, particularly at that age, that they're not essentially telling the truth. When we lie, we speak differently to when we're telling the truth. And a lot of people will be listening to that and thinking, yeah, absolutely. That's why you know when your partner's lying to you, your kids are lying to you, your parents are lying to you. There's just a different way that we express ourselves because we know that we're being deceitful. Often we over-exaggerate things or we add so much information to try to make it look like it's legitimate, or indeed we don't give a lot of information. It just isn't contextual with our normal way of speaking. So she just feels this unrest around what he's discussed. But he says, honestly, nothing's happened, Mummy. But she just feels that sense of, I don't really think he's being completely honest with me. And she even starts to suspect that he might have seen something, or even worse, been actually threatened by someone, but he's too scared to say anything. And a child would be, wouldn't they? Because if there's been a horrendous murder and somebody's threatened you and you're thinking to yourself, oh my God, it could be me next, or they've told you if you say anything, there's going to be consequences. Well, sure, if you're a kid, you're going to be silent. You know, it takes great courage to break that kind of belief system, because adults are terrifying, and if they have done something terrible, then why wouldn't it happen to you too? She suspects that this is the case. Now, whilst Derek, the child that has lost his life, would be described as this cute, blonde-haired, all-American kid who just everybody absolutely adored. Like I said, the whole village, the whole area absolutely adored this child. It's very different for Eric. Eric's experience growing up had been uniquely different. It really had been. So his mother, Tammy, she was epileptic. Now, while she was pregnant, she'd had to take, because clearly with epilepsy, grand mal seizures, they can be very, very disturbing, very painful, very problematic, and of course, incredibly dangerous. There are different things to do with epilepsy. We're talking about grand mal at this moment in time. So she'd taken this anticonvulsant medication to stop the seizures. Now, this medication, Tridione, it was actually later shown to cause really quite severe birth defects. And it was so prevalent that they actually named a condition after it, which was known as fetal trimethadone syndrome. So that shows you that it affected a lot of babies. And that's because that particular anticonvulsant medication was being given out willy-nilly. And the condition itself caused things like malformed ears, cleft palate, heart problems, and also skeletal abnormalities. Also, it could actually create a scenario where the child had delayed mental and physical development. The sales of the actual drug would be ceased in the USA, at least in 1996. But it's pretty harrowing to imagine that you're taking that medication to prevent yourself having serious seizures. You trust your doctor, and actually it's causing great damage to your unborn child. And we have to remember the fact that for the child, that's a lifelong problem. This is something that causes another life to have these huge issues. And because Eric was born with those physical characteristics, which were typical of a child suffering with fetal trimethadone syndrome, he ended up having this what I would say was quite an unusual facial appearance. He had these epicanthal skin folds on his upper eyelids. Now, they're common in people of Asian descent, but they're not common in people who are Caucasian. Also, he had these small folded low-set ears. And what the doctors actually said to Tammy was that he should have his ears taped back and everything would be okay. Not sure that particular doctor would be involved in plastic surgery, because clearly we all know that if you want your ears sorted, you'd have to have them pinned back. And a bit of tape isn't going to be working, is it? We'd all be wandering around, wouldn't we, with tape on our jowls and stuff if tape worked. But nonetheless, that would be distressing, because he ends up having his ears taped back and nothing happens. It doesn't help at all. So to some degree, now he's probably even more a figure of fun because he looks so distinct. Now, Eric's physical and mental development was also very much affected. He was delayed. So he didn't walk, he didn't talk until he was 2 years of age. And when he did actually start talking, he had this really serious speech impediment, which for a child is incredibly distressing. Lots of children have things like stutters, stammers, but the truth is, communication is so key. And when you can't communicate like your peers, when you can't communicate with other people around you, the frustration level is enormous. And we have to remember, for a child, this is very, very abandoning and isolating. And certainly Eric would have struggled with that. But the speech impediment for Eric was that he actually drooled whilst he was speaking right up until the age of 9. Just imagine how that's going to affect your peer relationships. He fell behind academically, and he's really standing out as very distinctly different from his friends. Now, at age 13, when they tested him, he was only performing at an academic level of an 8-year-old. He actually had to repeat the second and fourth grades at school, and that meant that he was still in a class with his little sister. And when you're in a class, you tend to hang around with people in your class. If your peers have moved on, the likelihood of you having strong relationships with them is going to be minimal. But also, the likelihood of you being able to maintain relationships with people in your actual year is going to be problematic, because they're going to see you as bigger, they're going to see you as different. And certainly when you have issues with your physical appearance, that's going to also cause problems in the relationships that you have. And this idea that we live in a fair world where people are kind and we can just say, be kind and don't bully one another, it's just not true. The world is about learning your place. And at times that can be incredibly difficult, because your place isn't a good space to inhabit. At the end of the day, there is a pecking order in life. It won't matter how many people tell you how to be. It won't matter how many people tell you things should be fair. They aren't fair. And certainly the more different you are, the more you stand out, the more likely you are to encounter problems. Because when we are similar, it means that we feel that we will instantly connect with individuals who look, act, seem similar to us. And indeed, when we're very different, that means that often we get isolated and abandoned by our peers. Now, despite the fact that Eric had all of these issues, and I don't think anybody needs a qualification in child development or psychology or teaching to understand that that slow developmental experience for him would be very alienating, they still didn't believe that he required any special educational help. So he didn't get a special educational placement. He was just left to manage the reality of what he was enduring on a daily basis. So unsurprisingly, his development was incredibly poor. He needed specialist care, without a doubt. He needed help. He needed guidance. He needed to not feel as distinct and different. He needed to be around teachers who fully understood his needs. And that just didn't happen. It's also worth noting that Eric had quite significant behavioural problems going up as well. So from the age of 2, he was having these really severe daily temper tantrums. He'd bang his head against things. He'd hold his breath. So if you've ever had a child who gets very, very upset, they can sometimes get to a point where they're struggling to breathe. It can be quite upsetting to even witness. They get themselves into a real state. And there are also times where children, particularly children who are struggling to express themselves, they'll express themselves in a range of behaviours that are very destructive and very terrifying, but also garner attention. And certainly breath holding and banging heads is one of those things. And I think that we're seeing in that action a level of great frustration. He's not happy. He can't express himself. He isn't getting what he needs. It's not because people are failing him. It's because he has these additional needs. And the problem with that is he does not know how to get what he wants from the world. Also, he acted really impulsively. And they said that this impulsivity was that he never had a regard for consequences. And even when he was 13, that was still happening. He would act without any kind of thinking. Eric had also, with respect, been pretty damn aware of the fact that he wasn't normal. So this isn't a child who's going through life thinking to themselves, oh, you know, this is just who I am. It's perfectly all right. I'm fine as I am. Actually, he really struggled. He didn't like himself very much at all. So one day, and this was a day after he'd attacked his sister, he actually told his stepfather, Ted Smith, Dad, I need help. But the truth is, even though he saw a need for that help, he didn't actually receive any. Instead, his stepfather had told him that he'd always taken out his anger on a punch bag when he was a kid. Now, I'm not going to suggest for one minute that that stepfather said the wrong thing. He's not qualified. He doesn't realise that actually what we don't want to do when somebody is very angry is encourage them to go and punch things. And the reason for that, and there'll be some people who dispute this, you'll say, well, I was a boxer, I was a Thai boxer, I was somebody who got into really expressive defence martial arts and punching things was helpful. I'm saying that that's very different. A discipline where you're being taught how to defend yourself and actually how to attack, but you're also being given these very clear boundaries about acceptability and appropriate behaviour within those boundaries is completely different from us telling young people what you need to do when you struggle is punch things. Because on one level, well, that's not really a problem if it's a punch bag. But I tell you what, if you get that feeling of provocation and you get that feeling of boiling over, and then you're in a situation where you don't have a punch bag, but you have somebody's face, that's something that we see as connected. So even though it kind of makes sense when you think about it just on a linear level of, well, I'm angry, I'm all pent up, let's go and punch some things. What we don't want to do is anchor those feelings, because that means that a child may well start to take their anger out inappropriately. And after his stepfather, who's obviously got good intentions in that moment, tells him that, Eric goes outside quite abruptly and he returns back a short while after and all of his knuckles are just bloodied and skinned. So when he's asked what's happened, he says he'd just gone out and punched a few trees. So again, you're in a situation where he goes out and punches a tree a few times, and now he's got that connection with, well, how did that feel? Yes, it hurt me, but at the same time, did it feel a sense of release? And what connection does that create? And then on top of that, what does that say about Eric? There's a desperation there, isn't there? Because he's literally said to his stepfather, I need help. And then he's been advised of what to do, and he's gone and followed that advice, literally. So there's a real desperation within this child in this moment as well. Also, let's be honest, kids can be really cruel, really cruel. And I've described to you the kind of limitations and issues that Eric was dealing with in his life. And he was relentlessly bullied. He was teased every single day of his life. And to additionalize the issues, he also had bright red hair and thick glasses. Now, as adults, we can all agree that people with red hair are absolutely beautiful, and there is something incredibly attractive about individuals, girls who have gorgeous long red hair and that pale white skin and freckles. But I will tell you, certainly in the UK, and I'm sure it's the same in many Western world areas, for whatever reason, kids tend to take pot shots at kids who have bright red hair. And also the fact that he has these thick glasses, again, is additionalizing potential for people to poke fun. He was also considered by his peers that he was a bit of a class clown. That doesn't surprise me. If you don't really have the skills to fit in with your peers, you'll find a role. We see that throughout life. It's one of the reasons why when you see reality TV shows, there's often real problems with certain characters because they tend to have that role and then someone equally as clownish comes in and wants that role or equally as superior comes in and wants that role. We all vie for a certain place in our society. Some of us right at the top, some of us right at the bottom, but my God, we'll find something that makes us connect and ideally stand out and ideally in the long term make us be able to forge relationships. And that's what he does. But the problem with that is it compounds the feelings of the children around him. Because when you're being the class clown, you're allowing yourself to be open to a lot of negativity. And you have to have a resilience beyond belief to be able to manage it. Because you're essentially acting the fool. And then when people start picking on you for acting the fool, it's an issue that you've kind of created for yourself. But at least you're getting some attention. Bear in mind, as you're growing up, the brain cannot distinguish between good attention and bad attention. It's why we should starve bad behavior. Simple as that. You don't want to react to it. You don't want to reinforce it. Just do that with the good stuff. Because the brain isn't able to compute the distinction. All it knows is it's better to have attention than not to be noticed. So he's growing up with that reality. And the kids that he was around, they bullied him incessantly. But also, he'd do things like get on the bus and they'd all go out of the way to trip him over. Can you imagine that day in and day out? Every single day of your life is full of torment and all you want is to just have friends. It's really soul destroying. So when I've told you all of those realities for Eric, it's not a surprise, is it, that he had very low self-esteem and he had very poor mental well-being. He had absolutely no friends. He became completely lonely, very, very depressed, very withdrawn. He would apparently just spend hours and hours every single day just cycling around alone. Apparently he cried every single day. He often referred to himself as stupid. And again, that lends us insight into the way that this experience as a child is compounding and then being taken on by the child themselves. So even though he isn't stupid, he has developmental issues and he has a medical condition. For him, it's all irrelevant. The reality for him is compared to his peers, he feels stupid. He's abandoned by his peers. So that means that he has a reality to those feelings and he can't change it. So he has no control and power over it. And that in itself, again, affects that self-esteem and self-image. He even went so far, and this is really heartbreaking, as to get the class photo and to scratch his image out of it. And he told his family the reason for that was he wasn't good enough to be on it. They are really big feelings for a child to manage. But I would say even more concerning than that was that early on he displayed the McDonald triad. So the McDonald triad is basically three particular facets, which is one, a child being fascinated with fire. But we're talking about a fascination with fire that exceeds normal childhood curiosity. Let's talk about somebody who would have been considered a pyromaniac, Son of Sam, David Berkowitz, 1400 fires in New York during his time of criminality. So that's the kind of level that we work towards in these scenarios with these kind of perpetrators, but it's very often seen in serial killers, actually. So this fascination with fire, killing and torturing small animals, and also he'd been very violent towards his older sister. He also suffered from chronic enuresis, so that's bedwetting, and he suffered that until he was 11 years of age. So he's got these traits that we actually expect to see where these young children graduate into much more serious attacks as they get older. And he has these. So that is deeply concerning when you think about all the other things that I've told you about. There's a real cooking pot of possibility regarding this potential in this child's life. Bear in mind as well, he's got all this trauma, hasn't he? Relentless bullying, teasing at school and home, because actually, the reality is that his sister was quite negative to him as well. And again, kids are cruel. If you are a sister of a child who maybe stands out in your community and you feel that maybe that kind of infects you and the attitude that people have towards you, you may well own some of those negative traits and start projecting them onto the brother or sister that you have. So this is happening as well. But also, there was extra trauma within his family circle. So first of all, he only discovers that his stepfather was not his actual biological father.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
When he was 9 years of age. So you're growing up, he obviously loved his stepdad, but he finds out that he's not actually the dad that he believed he was. As far as he's concerned, he's been being brought up with a family unit, and it turns out that's not true. But it's how he found it out that's even more disturbing. He actually discovered it through another pupil at school. Can you imagine how affronting and humiliating that would be? That some random kid at school, probably somebody who's bullied you, knows more about your intimate experience familially than you do. And if it isn't bad enough that he's going through that, he also discovers that his older sister had the same father. But whilst his biological father, the father of his sister, had stayed in contact with Stacey and been involved in her life, he'd wanted absolutely nothing to do with Eric. Nothing to do with Eric. Shame on that man. Shame on the biological father who clearly saw Eric as being different, decided that he was completely capable to have the capacity of a relationship with Stacey because she was normal. But when it came down to Eric, he'd just completely reject him. Eric was universally rejected by his peers and then discovers that he's been rejected by his own father. So this web of lies is going to be overwhelming for him. Imagine all the things that I've talked about so far today with Eric, and then imagine what kind of a child we're creating in this moment. And on top of all of these issues, which is just awful, it seems that Eric's stepfather may also have been prone to violence. And if that's not terrifying enough to add insult to injury, he also sexually molested his stepdaughter, Stacey. So when she's 11 and 14, he's abusing her. He'd fondled her breasts on one occasion. And this is highly inappropriate behaviour per se. She's 11 and 14. And what would you do in that situation? Because let me tell you, if you were living with me and you molested my children or my child, and I discovered that fact, then you better run so fast. And you better get out of my home so quick, because I will be in my car and I will find you. And let's just say you will not be walking after that experience. And I think most of us feel that way. But this isn't what happens. So this guy gets to inappropriately touch this girl and he just gets thrown out of the house for a week. He apparently undergoes psychotherapy, but then no action had been taken aside from that. That messaging, as far as I'm concerned, is horrendous messaging to give a child. It just says your issues are not serious. What happened to you isn't that important. And we should certainly forgive this predator. Said no rational human ever, let alone making that into a reality, which, as I've just described to you, actually happened. Now, what I will say is that Eric has said that he actually was never sexually abused. And again, that would not be unusual. Firstly, he's a different gender. So clearly a lot of paedophiles who are molesters have a predilection, be like boys or girls. So Eric is male, his sister is female, and it would not surprise me if there was no sexual abuse. But certainly the indication is there was violence in the home. So basically all the ingredients that I've talked about so far are literally textbook ingredients of creating a potential future violent offender. Feels as if the vast majority of the red flags that are literally so bright red, that they're almost burning, they've basically been ignored. So this is really concerning, because what we know is that when you have somebody with this potential, we need early intervention. We need therapeutic engagement. We need to notice If we don't notice, the child can sink further and further into inappropriate behaviours and negative thinking cycles. Let's take us back to the actual murder. So 3 days after Derek's absolutely brutal, senseless murder on Thursday, the 5th of August, 1993, Eric's mother ends up taking Eric to the actual police. So Tammy takes him there because she's absolutely convinced, she can't let it go, that he's hiding something. And she feels that if he's hiding something that could actually bring this killer to justice, he absolutely needs to be able to speak to the police and inform them. She wants this killer caught. Eric ends up getting interviewed by the detectives on 2 occasions. But when the detectives start to speak to him, they end up feeling that they've got more questions than answers. So first of all, he tells them that he'd been in and out of the park about 3 or 4 times that morning, but he hadn't actually seen Derek. Now, Eric didn't give them a lot of information, but what he did tell them, it really raised red flags because there were loads of discrepancies in his accounts. Bear in mind, remember, they've interviewed 500 people, so they've got a lot of witness statements. And when they're comparing the witness statements, Eric's just seems to be off. It doesn't seem to fit. So during the third interview of the day, this is actually at his home, he said something to the detectives that absolutely blindsided them. They say it almost caused them to fall out of their chairs. It was that overwhelming and unexpected. So Eric admits, out of the blue, to having seen Derek on the morning he was killed. He said he'd seen him between his home and the park that he was walking to, and he said that he was actually walking on the opposite side of the street whilst Eric said he was riding his bike. But this is where it starts to go really, really off. It's the way that Eric describes Derek's clothing. He even describes Eric's lunch bag, the canvas lunch bag, in detail. And at this moment, the police are like, hey, this doesn't make sense. They also think to themselves, wow, this must have been the last person who probably even saw Derek alive. And he's even in close proximity to where he was actually found dead. But they can't drop the skepticism. One of the reasons for that is because Eric's glasses, bear in mind what I've told you about his glasses, very thick glasses because he had impaired vision. Those glasses had actually been broken weeks earlier. And because of that, he can't see really well. So the police are blindsided because this kid has described in absolute acute, accurate detail the clothes that Derek was wearing, but also even the canvas bag that he was carrying in really accurate detail. How could he have noticed such detail from the opposite side of the street? And also, one of the things that kind of really, again, affects him is that during the actual interview, on 2 occasions, Eric gets really upset. His voice starts cracking. He actually put his head down, brought his fists up, and he asked the detectives, you think I killed him, don't you? Now, the detectives are like, absolutely not. Of course we don't think that you killed him. But Eric doesn't feel comforted by this. And he says to them, I'm not the type of person that would kill her or sexually molest anyone. Now, Eric's great-grandfather, he saw this distress and he ultimately asked the detectives to leave, which again, you can fully understand because hearing a child in such distress talking about something so upsetting, that's not something you're going to want to watch. You're not going to want to witness that. And potentially the detectives were pushing him a little bit. Understandably, there's a dead child. They want to bring the perpetrator to justice. But Eric's clearly finding this incredibly difficult. Now, later that same day, obviously the detectives want to keep up the momentum. So they ask Eric to come to the crime scene and they want him to show them exactly where he'd seen Derek. Now, apparently, according to the detectives, one of the things that kind of struck them was that Eric really seemed to enjoy the attention. And that makes perfect sense. Imagine being a kid. You're bullied every single day of your life. No one notices you. You're never considered important. You're on your own most of the time. And then suddenly, you've got these adult detectives and you're the focus of everything. You're important. You may have information that the detectives can get from you that essentially could break the case. And it must be intoxicating for Eric in that moment in time, because he's thinking to himself, wow, suddenly I'm important. I'm not used to this. Now, during the time that he's getting this attention and being asked to describe things, he actually asks one of the officers, what will happen to the person who actually did this? And he'd actually apparently asked also similar questions to a neighbour. Basically, he spent a lot of time at a particular neighbour, so he's asking them what would happen to the person who did this. And he went so far as to actually ask the neighbour, what would happen if it turned out a kid had done this? Now, at that point, she had rightly, to some degree, told him that the child had probably need to get some psychiatric help, probably need to be given the attention they deserve. So she hadn't played it in a way where it was, well, they'd be put to death. It was very much a, well, there'd be clearly something horribly wrong with this child and they'd need to be given the help, guidance and attention because this is not normal behaviour. He also asked questions about DNA testing. So very intrigued about the investigation, the consequences of what will happen to the person who's found out to be the perpetrator, but also trying to ask around how things will play out per se. The fact that he's asking about DNA testing, I mean, these are things that clearly he's just stated upon. He's thought out, okay, how are they going to find out who this is? How is the person going to get pinned on for this crime? Now, the following day, the police again are with Eric, and this time they actually want him to reenact exactly how things played out the morning that Derek was killed. And from the get-go, they can see that Eric isn't even able to see detail from across the street. He'd claimed he could, but they just test him, and he can't at all. So because of this, the police feel, well, he couldn't possibly have seen such accurate detail from across the road. And that must mean that he was closer to the victim than he was claiming. So there are all these inconsistencies, and that means the detectives keep returning to it again and again and again. So they question Eric later again that day, and then he doesn't really engage with them in a way that's giving them anything helpful. So after they've made a little progress, they basically send him home. It's 5 days after his death, Derek gets buried in his baseball uniform. Just harrowing, isn't it? This little boy, this little baby, so loved by everyone. And the testament to his love of baseball, the fact that they actually put him to rest in the outfit. But whilst this is all going on, we have Eric, who's discussing the killing with his parents. And after those interviews with the police, there's 2 days where it's quite intensive. He also spoke to his grandfather and his great-grandfather. Now, the latter, he was actually a former police officer. And to be fair, each of them, including his great-grandfather, who was a former police officer, and his mother, they all feel that he's holding something back. And they feel that he's holding some key information that could indeed affect and help the investigation. So it's 2 days after he's last spoken to the police. Eric's mum and great-grandfather, they're sitting with him and they're just saying, listen, it's so important that you tell the truth. You're not going to get into trouble for telling the truth. You could make a difference to this case. And they even say to him, if somebody's threatened you, if somebody's scared you, you don't have to worry about it. Tell us, we'll protect you. And it takes about half an hour of this real persuasion where they're reassuring Eric. And then suddenly he snaps and he tells them something that would change their worlds forever. And in doing so, change his forever. He said, Mum, I did it. I snapped and I'd done it. I'm sorry, Mum. I'm sorry I killed that little boy. You can imagine, can't you, the way that his mum feels in that moment. This is a woman who's been in reassuring him that it's all going to be okay, trying to coax this information out because her son has nothing to hide. He hasn't done anything wrong. Maybe he's scared because his horrible perpetrator is trying to threaten him. And all of a sudden, the reality is, Mum, it was me. Apparently, in that moment, she began screaming and shaking him. She demanded to know, why would you do such a thing? And he just kept repeating, I don't know why. His great-grandfather, of course, straight away just contacts the police and actually says to the police, the boy needs help. At this point, a meeting is quickly arranged because, of course, the police at this point may not believe that it was Eric. It could be a fantasy. It could be this boy colluding with the investigation because he feels that he's got to say something. Bear in mind, he's felt very important. This could just be an attentional issue. But they get this meeting and it's at the district attorney's office. And this is where the police interview Eric again. Now, bear in mind, he's only 13 years of age, but he still had to be read his Miranda rights, you know, the warning, i.e. the right to silence and the right to an attorney. And after he's actually read those rights, he's read that warning, he actually asks what an attorney is. So he doesn't have really any idea what's going on. He then has a 3-hour interview, and during that interview, he gives a really detailed confession. So first of all, he explains how on the morning of that morning, that dreadful, fateful morning where Derek lost his life, he'd been on a bike and he's cycling around on his bike and then he spots 4-year-old Derek and Derek's just walking along the street. He said, I looked to the left and I saw this little kid with blonde hair. He was walking towards the wreck. I turned around and went up behind him. And when I was within 10 feet, I said, hey, kid. The kid turned around and I caught up with him. At that point, I knew I wanted to take him someplace and hurt him. I asked the kid if he wanted to go to the wreck by way of a shortcut through the woods and beat everybody there. The kid said, no, I'm not supposed to. I said, it's okay, I'm right here. The kid then followed me through the empty lot. I let the kid go in front of me. When we got inside the trees, I put my arm around his neck. I was standing behind him. The kid then dropped his lunch. I continued squeezing harder as the kid made fists and swung his arms, trying to get away. I was gonna hold him against the tree and choke him with my hands. As I started to release him, he made a noise like he was trying to gasp some air, like weird noise. So I said, forget it, and squeezed harder. I let it go on for 30 seconds or so. He didn't make any noise. So I let him down on the ground. His eyes were closed and I don't know if he was breathing. There was a little rock lying beside him and I hit him in the head 3 times. Then I picked up a bigger rock. I threw the rock with both hands down on his head. At this point, blood began running from his nose and the rock fell to the side. 2 more times, I picked it up and I threw it onto his head. I then picked up another big rock. I threw that rock into the middle of his chest. Now I remember that whilst he was lying on the ground before I hit him with the rock, he was gasping for air. Then I dumped his lunch on the side of the ground, which consisted of a sandwich, cookie, Kool-Aid, plastic reusable container, and something else, which I can't recall. Also, I saw a paper napkin and put it in his mouth. As I tried to stuff the baggie in his mouth, he bit me. It hurt, but it didn't leave any marks. I pulled my finger in the baggie out and threw the baggie down. Then I began hitting him in the head with the rocks. I picked up the Kool-Aid and poured it on his face on the right side of his temple area where I'd hit him with the small rock and his chest. At this point, I don't know whether I pulled his pants down or not. I must have taken them down. I then looked around for a stick and picked one off a tree. I then flipped him over and I stuck up his butt, then flipped him over again and I dragged him to a rock pile. Then I left the area. After about 5 minutes at wreck, I went back to the body. I was worried if he wasn't there, then he might say something. I figured if he's dead, and I believed he was, I won't have to worry about anything. When I arrived back at the wreck, it started thundering and stuff, and Bill Horn, the director, told everyone to go home. It's pretty astonishing, isn't it, to be able to kind of recount that confession, the detail of it, and also the fact that he's just talking about this little 4-year-old child who's still alive when he's carrying out these most heinous attacks. It's incomprehensible to imagine that that little boy was murdered that way. Now, the description that I've just given you of clearly the violence that was used against Derek, bear those in mind because the autopsy mirrors that. They're consistent with the amount of sheer force that was used. So Eric is his teenager, he's relatively young, but wow, the rage that is exhibited in what we've talked about is harrowing. So Derek had these severe head injuries. He had multiple skull fractures. He had cerebral swelling and contusions. He had extensive tearing and bleeding of tissues in the chest. He had a perforation of the intestinal wall. He had pinpoint hemorrhaging on the neck, face and eyes that was caused by the strangulation, by the asphyxiation. It's harrowing to imagine this is a four-year-old child this has been carried out on. But it transpired, literally, that only minutes before he'd seen and attacked Derek, Eric had been seriously threatened by a grown-up man. So there was this group of local insurance agents. They'd been having a meeting around a picnic table close to the crime scene. And Eric had been being very annoying. You know, there's a group of adults. They're having a meeting around a table. It's business related. And as a kid, you bump in the table with your bicycle. That is going to piss people off. It is, without a shadow of a doubt. And clearly that speaks to some of the behavioural issues that Eric was dealing with. Now, one of the agents was really annoyed. And he got up, he threatened him, and he'd indicated that he could beat him up. He then said, "I bet you I have a gun in my glove compartment and I can shoot you." Probably not the most well-adjusted human adult there. I mean, okay, tell the kid they're pissing you off, ask them to remove themselves and vacate the area, but I think we're going a little bit too OTT when you're threatening a child with their life. You're basically saying, yeah, you don't stop doing this, I'm gonna kill you. Anyway, during this altercation, another agent did intervene, put a stop to it. At this point, Eric had apparently left very quietly, but minutes later, he'd killed Derek. So I guess that one of the things that we can draw a conclusion from there is that the rage internally and the helplessness and the lack of control in that moment for Eric is potentially bubbling over into this frustration and aggression, and the humiliation is felt by the actual individual who's just told him that he could kill him. All these things are causing that cooking pot to bubble over. Now, Eric's family had, of course, when it came to the actual way he was going to be treated by the courts, assumed that because he was young, it would be dealt with in the family court. Makes perfect sense, doesn't it, when you're thinking about, we've got a 13-year-old. They believed that Eric was somebody who needed a hell of a lot of treatment, and evidently he'd received that at the juvenile treatment centre. But that's not how it's going to play out. The prosecutor says, we have no intention to prosecute him in the family court. We have an intention to prosecute him for murder, and we are going to try him as an adult in criminal court. Murder, to be honest, when you look at the law in New York, it's the only offence in the state of New York that a child as young as 13 can be tried as an adult. The only offence. So it's seen as that serious that it cannot be considered in context with other types of young offending. Now, this was shocking for the family. A lot of people will agree that at 30, you should be...
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
As an adult. But I think we can all agree there is a massive distinction between being 13 and being 23. There is a massive distinction between being 13 and 33. But when it comes down to murder, that's not considered the case in New York. So Eric's attorney, understandably and rightfully so, requests psychiatric and psychological reports because they want to established the most suitable venue for the trial. But the prosecutor flat out refuses it. And the reason for this is that as far as they're concerned, he says, I think Eric's not mentally ill. He said, I truly believe that Eric Smith was a budding serial killer. There are clearly people who make choices which reflect pure evil. In my view, this heads the list. What would I say about that? Well, I'm going to be honest with you. I would say that there must have been some form of mental illness. I mean, kids don't usually go around beating other children to death with rocks and sodomising them with sticks. And let's just say that they are a consistent offender who did happen to do that. You'd still expect that there'd be some kind of emotional reaction to it. But Eric didn't display any. So there was something almost missing. So this isn't a typical child. This isn't a child who's processing the world normally. And certainly when we've looked at his background, there are massive red flags that really should have been dealt with earlier on. Now, he's facing at this point a criminal trial in an adult court. So Eric's attorney are looking for a way of ensuring that Eric doesn't get the most horrendous type of sentence. Because remember, you know, you're looking at potentially life without parole, and he's 13. So Eric's attorney decide that they want to use a defense of insanity. So in an insanity plea, you need to prove that due to a mental defect of some kind, Eric either didn't know what he was doing, or if he did know what he was doing, he didn't actually know that it was wrong. Or alternatively, you can also avoid a murder conviction if you're able to prove that at the time of the killing, Eric was suffering from an extreme emotional disturbance. Now, if that was pled successfully, he would be convicted of a lesser offence of manslaughter. There's a lot at stake. So a murder conviction, just to put this in context, that would result in a sentence of anything between 9 years to life. And obviously life can mean life. Now a manslaughter conviction, that's completely different. First of all, it would take the case out of the adult system. So we'd be looking at a juvenile detention and a treatment order instead. So in the preparation for the trial, Eric's attorney, they seek out a psychiatric opinion. And a child psychologist, they concluded that this was a child who harbored a great deal of internal rage, that they'd been festered, created by feelings of rejection and abandonment, and that when he reached a level where he was so enraged with how he felt about his world, the unfairness, the frustration, he actually became completely detached from his own actions and the consequences of those actions. So his conclusion actually did support the insanity defense. And this is a quote from it. The mental disease from which he suffers is such that he was unable to appreciate either the legal or moral implications of his actions at the time of the crime. So this sense of almost being disassociated from the reality of what he was carrying out. So he's a perpetrator, but he's a perpetrator that is essentially completely unable to control his actions. Meanwhile, a pediatrician and child psychiatrist concluded that Eric suffered from intermittent explosive disorder. This is a condition that's characterized by aggressive impulses, which basically far outweigh any type of provocation. So it's a little bit like if somebody annoys you in the car because they overtake you at a point where you don't feel that they should. That would be characterized by you then chasing that car, pulling them over and beating them up. It's not actually the provocation deserving of such a reaction. But in this particular condition, that's what would happen. You just cannot deal with any level of provocation. And when it occurs, you just lose your rag entirely. Now, this meant that he concluded that the attack on Derek was not actually a premeditated murder, but it was this result of Eric's pathological rage. So again, that particular report agrees to some degree that Eric had acted in a state of extreme emotional disturbance, and it's a defence, therefore, to murder. But we get a very different result from the forensic psychiatrist for the prosecution. So that forensic psychiatrist, they concluded that Eric didn't have any form of mental illness. And instead, they diagnosed him with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which basically provided absolutely no explanation for or defence to killing Derek. So we have both sides to some degree a stalemate. And in scenarios like that, it really is going to be the way that the prosecution prosecutes, the way that the defence defends, and of course the decision of the jury, because there is no clear cut. Prosecution saying not a problem, not even an issue. And the defence is saying massive issue. Kid can't control himself, needs help, doesn't need to be banged up in prison. The trial starts July 1994. And there's some real sad parts as far as I'm concerned that really reflect what we're dealing with here, which is a child killer as opposed to an adult killer. By the way, please be aware that my only concern in this particular video is Derek and Derek's family. They're the people who have lost horrifically. A child has been murdered in a devastating way and was completely innocent of what occurred and should absolutely be at the centre of what I'm talking about today. But nonetheless, there are moments which really hit me as a mother. So Eric was wearing a Bugs Bunny sweatshirt often. I don't think you get more childish than that. Also, this is an overwhelming position to be in. It's terrifying. And yet he doesn't show any kind of emotion. He's just really blank, totally unemotional, doesn't express any remorse. So literally textbook worst type of defendant. What you want is to see people breaking down, particularly when we're talking about child murder. If I bring you back to a case like James Bulger in the UK, one of the things that John Venables was seen as was the emotional, upset, remorseful, whereas Robert Thompson was seen as blank and unemotional, and therefore Robert Thompson was painted as the aggressor, essentially. As it plays out, Robert Thompson has actually gone on to live a pro-social life, whether you agree with that or otherwise. He's certainly not the one who ended up the repeat offender. That's Venables. So again, just because somebody isn't showing remorse or emotion in a court of law doesn't mean that there aren't feelings going on. But if you're on the jury, that's going to be something that's a big red flag. And if you've got to make a decision, it's not always just based on evidence, although there is a hell of a lot of evidence here that clearly suggests guilt. You're going to also think about, what does this defendant come across like? Do I want this defendant walking the streets? Do I feel this defendant understands the gravity of the crime? And that's an emotional response. And when you're making emotional responses, you're going to act on the feelings that seem to connect with the bias you have about how an offender should seem and express themselves, if they're innocent or if they are somebody who's absolutely recognised the reality of their crimes and is devastated by them, you're going to see that. And if you don't, you're going to think, this person doesn't care. So a jury of 6 men and 6 women, they're watching all this play out on the jury. And they've even shown one of the large rocks that are used to kill Derek. Prosecution goes ahead and presents the medical evidence. And the prosecution argued that even if they decided that Eric did suffer from a mental disorder, as far as they were concerned, it still provided no defence. Because they said he must have, no matter what, have absolutely known it was wrong. And that's why he'd taken Derek off the street and out of sight to kill him. And later gone back to the body to make sure that Derek was dead, because he didn't want to get found out. So the fact that he knew what he was doing, did it privately, and then made sure that he wasn't going to get implicated, that suggested that he understood his actions. The defence medical expert, they relayed the actual details of the interviews that they had with Eric. And the defence medical expert said he just became angry when he saw Derek. And he said to himself he wanted to hurt him. He was feeling very angry and had to let the anger out. So he began to choke Derek and said to himself, I can't let go. Now, in a later interview, Eric actually explained that it's the mad switch. He got mad. He got angry. He wanted to get it out. Thought about all the people who picked on him. Also thought about a girl that he'd asked out who'd said to him, you're too ugly. I don't want to go out with you. He also said that Eric had said this about Derek. He's smaller and practically helpless. I had to get my anger out on him. I wanted to hurt him. So the expert explained how a child with this intermittent explosive disorder could go from basically normal, absolutely normal, to having this rage attack within 10 to 15 minutes. So it could come out of the blue, essentially. And that certainly seemed to be the case when we look at the attack with Eric. And then bear in mind, after he'd actually carried out the murder, he goes back and returns to the recreation program. So this is explosion and then this calm. So the fact that he appeared normal after the killing, the expert said, in his defense, showed that he wasn't actually normal. You'd expect huge agitation, fear, panic, all of these things. You wouldn't expect a child to just go back to the rec and get on with playing. That isn't contextual, it isn't typical. However, as you guys all know, that's not going to fly with the actual prosecution, is it? Because the prosecution are there to make it absolutely clear that this was premeditated, it's most definitely murder, and they do not want Eric being given any leeway. They don't want his mental health being brought into question. Even if it is brought into question, they don't want that to be used as a defense. They're saying it's not enough. They want to send this kid down. He's murdered this beautiful little boy in the most horrendous, aggressive, violent, sadistic of ways. And they don't want him going anywhere apart from adult prison. Simple as that. They want him tried as an adult. They want him to be moved to a prison as an adult when he gets to the age he can be. That's how they feel they'll have done their job. So the expert for the prosecution, they maintain that Eric isn't suffering from intermittent explosive disorder. They say it's a very, very rare condition and it's only ever usually seen in adults. I'm going to be honest with you, I don't think that's fair. It's not for 1 minute I'm defending Eric at this moment in time. I'm saying I don't think it's fair to say that you tend to only see it in adults. I think that adults cause a huge amount of issues when they have this particular apparent disorder, and therefore, of course, you're going to notice it more because they're much more likely to be criminalized. They don't have adult parents who can manage their behavior to a point where it isn't dealt with criminally. Usually, when you have a kid with this kind of explosive behavior, it's going to be managed in the home. I have certainly worked with children in the past who are explosive for 5 minutes and then have no idea what they did or why they did it. So the idea that this isn't seen in children is something that I think is incorrect. And the idea that this is an adult-only issue, again, is something that just makes no sense. I have no understanding why they would say that, because you grow into the adults that you are, and that stems from the children that you have been. So it might be very rare, and it is indeed, even in adults, very rare, but those adults were children. So I think it's nonsensical. But the expert also notes that as far as he is concerned, what is really notable is that Eric waits to make sure that nobody else is around. So there are no other kids around. And he believes as an expert that if Derek had other kids around, then Eric would not have felt that he could be his victim, because he would have felt that it wasn't safe. People would have known it was him. So there is a level of manipulation that Eric knew that other people weren't there, so it was unlikely that they would be able to pin him to the crime. So he says that shows a level of control over his anger. So the expert concluded this. They said that Derek may have been a very unusual or peculiar trigger who symbolised someone well cared for and, as a child, successful and competent. All the things Eric himself felt he was not. So the suggestion there is that just the image of Derek, the successful, loved, popular, gorgeous little boy, the whole world at his feet, that enraged Eric to a point where he just thought, I want to hurt that kid, because that kid has everything that I don't feel that I have. And I'm going to project all of my rage and anger and frustration and abandonment and isolation and alienation. I'm going to project it all on this child, because this child is exactly what I'll never be. And the expert comes from that position. But of course, that position also means that as far as the expert is concerned, and bear in mind, if you're listening on a jury, this is quite compelling. He's saying this child knew exactly why he went for Derek. This child knew exactly what Derek symbolised, and this child was controlled enough to select this child to make sure that no one was around this child, so that ideally he could vent those frustrations and that rageful intent and project all of that anger and get away with it. So that's quite compelling, bearing in mind we're dealing with the murder of a 4-year-old little boy. We get to the 16th of August, this is 1994. There's 11 hours of deliberations. The jury reject the insanity and the extreme emotional disturbance defences. So Eric ends up getting convicted of second degree murder. And at this point, they actually sentence him to life in prison with a minimum term of 9 years. 9 years doesn't sound a long time, does it? But when we use the term minimum term, that means the amount they will serve before they're even considered for parole. But let me tell you, there are people 40 years down the line in prison who had minimum terms. So that doesn't necessitate that you're going to walk free. And I think that many people would genuinely believe that 9 years isn't a time you should walk free when you've carried out such a heinous slaying of a beautiful little boy. So Eric gets sentenced. He spends the first 3 years of his sentence in a juvenile detention center. So that would be with kids of his age group. I'm sure that that would be upsetting for him. But at the same time, I imagine that he will be with levels of peers and it won't be as intimidating, certainly, as what we expect to see in the adult detention environment. I will say that during his incarceration, he did start to really express remorse for his actions. He even wrote a letter to Derek's grieving parents, which he read out on TV. He said, "I know my actions have caused a terrible loss in the Roby family, and for that, I'm truly sorry. I've tried to think as much as possible about what Derek will never experience. He'll never experience his 16th birthday, Christmas, any time, owning his own house, graduating, going to college, getting married, his first child. If I could go back in time, I would switch places with Derek and endure all the pain I've caused him. If it meant that he would go on living, I'd switch places, but I can't."
I knew I had a problem with anger. I knew I do. I might be, you know, just happy-go-lucky now and someone get me mad.
In 2001, Eric was 21, so 7 years in. He gets transferred to the Clinton Maximum Security Prison in Dannemora, New York State. That's a big shift and a big change, isn't it? So now he's really in the system. And he becomes eligible for parole in 2002. This is when he's 22. Unanimously rejected. Parole application is unanimously rejected. And every 2 years from that point onwards, they have to consider his application. But the parole board clearly, at this point, think that he's still a danger to society. Bear in mind as well that when we talk about the parole board, every 2 years from that point onwards, looking at this case, what we also have to simultaneously remember is poor Derek's family. So for those of you who know a lot about crime, you will probably be aware that the family is considered during that period of time, because clearly the victim's family deserves to say how they feel and how the freedom of the perpetrator would impact on their lives. And that needs to be considered, and it's considered strongly, absolutely considered strongly. I've worked with people writing letters to the parole board to express how they feel about the potential of a perpetrator being freed. So it's very important that you involve them, but it also means you are constantly dragging up their feelings. How do you move on when you're constantly having to say, "I don't want this person out. I want this person to be in prison because they murdered my child"? Every 2 years, this is being considered. This is something incongruous with moving on. You can never move away.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
From the death of a child, the murder of a family member, it's always going to be a stain on everything within your world. It's always going to be a loss that's so powerful and unique that it's going to be impossible to overcome. But your life can still have meaning. But when you're constantly returning to that origin, to the moment of the loss, I think that must be psychologically so traumatizing, psychologically so devastating and so anchoring to the moment that I can't imagine that you breathe a moment during those periods of time where it's not consuming you. It's only my own perception of it, but I can't imagine anything else. I think for Derek's parents, it would have been horrific. There's no closure on their son's death. Every 2 years when Eric applies for parole, they have to live the horror of it again and again and again. And this isn't me coming down hard on Eric. Of course, Eric is going to be applying for parole every 2 years because there is a chance that he is going to be given his freedom, emancipated from his situation. Of course, that's the case. He's now 22, 24, 26. He's not the 13-year-old kid anymore. He's probably gone through a hell of a lot of change in prison. So he wants to get out. He wants a life for himself. Now, during the time in prison, Eric ends up reflecting on the motive for his killing, and he stated this. So after a few years of verbal abuse and having been told that I'm nothing, I just shut down my feelings. So I wouldn't feel the emotional pain, which made me vulnerable and weak, but the damage was done. I began to believe that I was nothing and nobody, and my outlook on life was dark. I felt that when I went to school, I was going to hell, because that's what it was for me. He admitted at the time of the killing that it made him feel good. He said, instead of me being hurt, I was hurting someone else. I mean, that's chilling, I'm going to be honest, because it's very much about him. But I guess that the interviewer was asking him about him, and that's only a small part of what would have been said. But it's fixed on how he feels about how his life was difficult. And I know that he's trying to explain how those feelings cut him off from emotion and made him concentrate on the anger, bitterness and hostility, but he still made a choice to literally execute a child. Now, Eric gets denied parole 10 times. 10 times. That's 10 times Derek's family have to go through this. 10 times. That's 20 years of parole boards. Can you imagine? 20 years. Eric's finally granted parole in October 2021, so very recent. He actually got released in February 2022. By this point, he was 42. He'd spent 28 years in prison. It's a long time. Remember, he was 13. But he murdered a little boy. I think we have to always hold on to the fact that whilst Eric is definitely a victim to some degree in his life, I genuinely believe that. It's why I've gone into so much detail about Eric, because this is not a child who had an easy time. It is not a child who felt like he fitted in and was accepted. He had some really horrible things happen to him. There is no doubt whatsoever, but he still murdered a four-year-old little boy. But during his time in prison, he expressed that he'd developed this real desire. He wanted to use what had happened to him as an experience to do something good. So he decided he wanted to counsel bullied children. And in fact, he hoped that one day he'd become a forensic psychologist, and he wanted to specialise in researching children who kill. So I suppose a completely different position to be in to when he went into the actual prison system, the scenario of actually thinking maybe who I am could eventually lead to something positive for our society. And of course, that's not going to make up for 1 minute what happened. The legacy of that poor little boy lives on and always will do in the hearts of his parents, in the hearts of his community. But the idea that Eric is now thinking, well, who I was and who I am, if I am able to connect those and research and then change the path of others, maybe, just maybe, I can give a life that was so negligible of meaning some sort of meaning, because Eric's life before this didn't have any meaning, essentially. So he now lives in Queens, New York, and interestingly, he's actually engaged to a woman who corresponded with him in prison. So she'd been researching the juvenile justice system for her law studies. And during these interactions, they'd fallen in love. He actually admitted something that I think is quite brave, to be honest. He said that if he hadn't been caught back in 1993, he probably would have gone on to kill again. And I think I concur with that. He had all the traits of a serial killer, genuinely, as a kid. And violent offenders like him, unless there is something hugely intervention-wise appropriate and acknowledged and accepted by the perpetrator, a really strong chance that these kind of behaviours will exist for a lifetime. So I think it's brave of him to acknowledge that. The prosecutor from the original trial, he'd actually earlier expressed a lot of fear and concern about Eric's release. He actually said this: it's a huge gamble. This parole decision is a high-risk enterprise, to be sure. I think that's fair. I genuinely do. Listen, I'm into rehabilitation. I am into a belief system that particularly where kids that kill, they can absolutely go on to live pro-social effective lives in the future. I don't think it's fair, necessarily. I don't think it's fair that, you know, a child is horribly murdered and this other person gets to go and live the rest of their life in society, get married, maybe have kids, have a career. I don't think it's fair. But I also think it's essential for a society that is developed, for a society that believes in hope, that we have to offer these potentials. But I think the parole officer is just being honest there. He's killed before, and that means certainly if past behavior can predict future behavior, that he may kill again. Now, Derek's parents, let's remember, not only Derek is the absolute victim here, we have a whole family who are victims here. So Doreen and Dale, they actually made a conscious decision to let go of the decades of anger that they'd felt. They wanted to heal. Doreen actually said this: I understand why after so many years they decided to give him a chance. And that's fine. You know, for him and his family. You know, he's been released. But in a way, so have we. No more parole. Now I can get on with my life. Now the true healing can begin. Again, I think that's so brave of her. I think Doreen and Dale are amazing. I think the fact that even in the release of their child's killer, they can find a level of hope and also a level of compassion. They let go of the hate and the anger. They let go of the unfairness, and instead they say, holding us to the death of our son is preventing us from living the life that he was not allowed to live, was not given the opportunity to live. So in letting go and allowing themselves to live, essentially they're not denying, they're not abandoning Derek. They're celebrating what he didn't have the opportunity to have, something that they would have wanted so much for him, a future. And I think they're incredible examples of peaceful, forgiving human beings. Now, Doreen and Dale have actually moved since Derek's death, but never from the area. They still live in Savona. And the reason for that is that it's Derek's home. It's Derek's memory. It's steeped, in fact, in Derek's memory. And they say that the thought of ever leaving, it would just feel like they were going to abandon him, and they don't want to abandon him ever. Every 2nd of August, on the anniversary of his death, they have Derek's favourite treat to celebrate his life. They have vanilla ice cream. Or white ice cream with sprinkles, as Derek called it. Sorry, I don't know why that set me off. I think there's just something so childlike, you know. We've had children. I'm sure many of you have had children, and vanilla ice cream with sprinkles is just one of their go-tos, isn't it? So every 2nd of August, that's what they do. They celebrate his life, even though it's on the actual day that he died. The crime scene where Derek was actually killed, they've bulldozed that now, and they've actually put a new ball field, which stands in its place. And that's in memory of Derek, which is just lovely, isn't it? Because he absolutely adored baseball. And now it's essentially dedicated to him, which is just beautiful. Then in May 2022, they actually unveiled a statue of him. And it's a statue of Derek in his T-ball uniform in a batter's stance. So he's forever immortalised there. He's forever remembered. He's forever a part of the place where he never had to grow into an adult, the opportunity, but that he's remembered every single day for the beautiful boy that he was and that he is, forever immortalised as that child. And I know and believe in my heart of hearts that he'll be reunited with his family in the future. Sorry, I've completely lost it today, haven't I? Just something about these moments where the humanity of children's lives, the importance of human lives and children dying this way, it's hard to concentrate and communicate the amount of feelings that I have regarding this, and just those moments where you think about his favourite ice cream treat and how so many of us can relate to that. I would really like to think that people who commit really serious violent crimes as kids can be rehabilitated and really live useful, productive lives. And I genuinely, genuinely hope that this is the case with Eric Smith. And I really hope that the parole board will not live to regret the decision of granting him freedom. I really do. I really hope that Eric Smith is an example of how rehabilitation can work. I hope that Eric Smith goes on to live a productive life. I hope he goes on to become somebody who can instruct us to understand more about child killers. And I hope that Eric Smith grows into a further, more compassionate adult than he is already. Because I believe, from what I understand, that there have been significant changes. And whilst not everybody will believe that he deserves a second chance, I think I do. In spite of the heinous actions, I think I do. Let's hope that the parole board were indeed right. And let's hope that Eric Smith is an example of how change can occur and how healing can be created.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.